Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikulskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is the New York Times bestselling author, Roseanne Perry. She is out with a brand new novel for young people. This is called A Horse Named Sky. It is available everywhere. Roseanne, as I first realized that as I started to read a book where the main character is a horse, it took me back to the 1980s watching The Tonight Show with my grandmother, and Johnny Carson and Ed McMahon would have this constant battle over which animal was smarter, a pig or a horse. And I think it was Ed McMahon that always argued for horses. But writing a book with a horse, that's a very intelligent animal. And so can you kind of describe what it's like to try to put yourself in the mindset of an animal of that sort of intelligence?
Yeah, I really loved writing about horses, and one of the things that I found the most moving in both researching horses and then actually getting out there into Eastern Oregon and watching them was how devoted they are to their band. You know, it was really beautiful to see, and to see how alert and aware they are of everything. I remember watching a band where there was a lead stallion and a bunch of mares and foals, and then off to the side there was a bachelor band of horses, and which are just young male horses that aren't attached to a family band yet. And these young male horses, they had been just grazing, and then they started like kicking and starting a fight with each other. But the minute one of them reared up to actually punch at another one, the lead stallion of the band right next door just fixed those horses with a stare. Didn't even say anything, just fixed them with a stare. And you would think they were like teenagers caught smoking behind the gym. It was over. They were completely done with just this really firm look from the stallion. I thought, wow, that is a lot of, community cohesion. You know, that they would take that lead stallion so seriously. And anyways, it was pretty impressive to see, and so I enjoyed that a lot.
You know, something I didn't think about until I read this book is when we think about westward expansion in this country after the Louisiana Purchase, we always think of the western part of the United States as a vast wasteland of nothingness and darkness. But that's not entirely true, because you had an entire continent full of animals. And so as westward's expansion going on, the book's set in the mid-19th century, what does the landscape of the United States look like as it's going there, taking it up to the time of the Pony Express? Because that's really what gets this story going.
Yeah, so the story is set in 1860, but up until then, I mean, there were vibrant cultures here since the Ice Age, right? The Paiutes are the tribe who are in the territory where the story takes place, and they have been there for thousands of years, and they have a well-developed and organized culture of moving from resource to resource and exploiting each one and maintaining each one so that it's healthy from year to year. In my research, I came across lots of artifacts from that culture that has that were ancient, and that was really great to see. And the American West had this, the inland prairies were incredibly diverse. There were hundreds of kinds of grasses out there, and wildflowers, and a lot of Nevada was a much moister place back then. The whole wetlands were still functioning back then. In fact, Reno was built on top of a wetland. And so before mining and other things and grazing that disrupted that environment, it was a really vibrant, healthy, amazing place. So that was pretty cool to learn about. I love talking to all the people that I work with when I'm researching a book. And I talked to a range specialist from the University of Nevada and some wild horse advocates. It was there's a lot to learn out there. Yeah.
The other thing I thought about as a writer for you, when I speak to writers who write about maybe a CIA agent or a detective, you can go talk to people in real life who do those type of jobs. But as a writer, when you're researching a book like this, you can't go talk to a horse, but you're simply trying to assign their attributes by observing their behavior. So what are the challenges that you come across as a writer doing this type of research when you're trying to assign different mindsets to a character based solely on their behavior, not on anything they tell you?
Yeah, it is an interesting puzzle, and so I want to make sure in my book that the actual physical things that the horses are doing are all within the regular repertoire of what a wild horse would do, right? I don't want their behavior to be extraordinary in any way. But in talking to wildlife biologists, one of the things that I'm really struck by is, although there are reasons not to personify animals, especially if you're doing research on them, there are also good reason not to deny them emotions and motivations that we would prefer to reserve for humans. So taking what I can see in their behavior and understanding that they have complex social dynamics and really rich and interesting social lives, right? Just drawing from that behavior and saying, well, what would be a logical thing, right? That sort of cornerstone experience in a male horse's life is being driven out of their family band. It happens to all of them. And really thinking about, oh, what would that feel like? And how can I make that feeling accessible to a young reader? So that's kind of my starting point, I would say.
It seems like with any book, you've got a protagonist and an antagonist. And for me, as I read it, the antagonist in this book was really humanity in and of itself. And I think about this as I watch a parade, like the Rose Bowl, the Rose Parade or something. I'll see the Budweiser Clydesdales. And I always think, do they really want to be doing this? I mean, advertising beer, or would they rather be running around in the wild? And so when really humanity is the antagonist, is it always that simple between animals and humans that one is usually the protagonist, the one's the antagonist?
You know, the big survival strategy for wild horses is that they have gotten us to domesticate them, and then we feed them and care for them and house them, and for a lot of horses, it's been a good deal. Of the wild horses in the world, zebras and Przewalski's horses are both endangered and have never been domesticated. Domestic horses are not endangered, not even close, in part because they have figured out how to form a partnership with humans, right, which has maintained them for centuries. So I think horses do genuinely form a bond with people because they are social animals, and because I think the body language of horses and humans is not that different from each other. And so it is easy to guess what a horse is thinking and feeling, and it is easy for a horse to guess what a human is thinking and feeling. And so I think it makes that bonding easier in a way that other animals I've written on don't. Wolves don't like us at all. Orcas could care, right? But horses really do seem to be able to form a bond with us. So I wouldn't say that humans are their enemy, but I will say that the destruction of the habitat has been incredibly challenging for the survival of wild horses.
I'm chatting with the New York Times bestselling author Roseanne Perry about her brand new book, A Horse Named Sky. Roseanne, as I thought about this, I tried to take myself out of the human aspect of the story, and for instance, Sky, a wild Mustang, but for domesticating, you know, for here it's the use for the Pony Express, but for any other use, what would the benefit of a wild Mustang be for humanity, for the environment, if they were simply left to the wild and never domesticated?
They help keep the range healthy, right? They're not, when they graze, they nip the grass off and they don't yank it out like many other grazing livestock do. So they're good at maintaining the prairie. They don't, they distribute their, shall we say, fertilizer widely because they travel dozens of miles in a day, and they're part of a functioning ecosystem, right? They so I think, and the value of wild horses too is their beauty and how inspiring they are to people. I think there will always be a place for domestic horses, but I think there is nothing quite like, you know, watching the sun coming up and seeing 100 wild horses come to a spring in the wilderness, one band after another, each one yielding to the next one and taking their turn and moving on. That's an amazing and inspiring sight. And I think we're lucky to have the wild horses that we do.
But for human involvement with wild horses and, you know, wild mustangs specifically, is the lifespan affected by their interaction with humanity versus if they were just left to the wild to their own devices?
Well, the average life of a wild horse, if you get past that first year, and young wild horses are more vulnerable than domestic ones, I would say, but if they can survive that first year, most wild horses live longer than domestic horses, actually. As long as they have regular access to water, they can live well into their 40s.
Wow. Tell me about this treehouse that you write from. I thought that was so intriguing.
Oh, it's my favorite place. It doesn't have walls. It just has a roof and, like, a waist-high fence going around it. So it's my summer writing spot, and I just love it up there. I love to be up in the trees. I have four children, and when they were all little, it was like enough away from them that I didn't have to open every jar of peanut butter, but not so far away that they could get in trouble. And just being outdoors with fresh air and songs of birds is a much more appealing way to write to me than than being stuck in an office, sitting in a chair all the time. So, and also my family over the years have built a rock wall and a zip line and a slide and other fun elements. So I do have the funnest office in town, I'm sure.
Well, I have this image of you almost as Abraham Lincoln studying by candlelight in his room. Is it like that, or do you use a laptop, or are you writing this longhand up there?
Well, I run an extension cord out there so that I can plug in my laptop if I need to. So I do some writing by hand, but most of my writing I do by computer. But yeah, it's pretty spare up there, which is actually quite helpful. You know, there's nothing to eat, there's nothing to clean, there's nothing. It's just the writing part of my writing life, not the business part of my writing life. And so I can really focus in on that element of it, which is super helpful.
Well, it's just a fascinating story of a tale of American history and nature combined. The book is called A Horse Named Sky. It's by the New York Times bestselling author Roseanne Perry. The book's available everywhere, and go check it out. And she's got a whole slew of books out there involving nature that are just fascinating to read. Roseanne, I love the book, and I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
Thanks so much, Brian. I appreciate it.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. I've been through the desert on a horse.